Welcome to the SureCast, a podcast produced by Bernstein Sure, covering a variety of law, public affairs, and community-related issues of interest. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the firm, and no advice in this podcast should be considered legal advice. If you are in need of legal counseling, please call Bernstein Sure at 207-774-1200. Thank you, and on with the show.
And joining us today on the SureCast is Jamie Broder, longtime face at Bernstein Sure, advocate for the aging, energy transmission devotee, and so much more. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Jamie.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You've been with Bernstein Sure for, when did you join?
2011. So finishing my ninth year.
And how has it been since you've been here?
It's been great. It's just been wonderful.
Great culture for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a firm that has an ethic and a culture that really involves everybody in a mission. And it's really a great opportunity to be able to do what I do and have the resources and the people who can help me get that work done.
Talk about a great resource you are in coming to Bernstein Sure. I was really interested to learn about a presidential appointment that you received, and it was President Ronald Reagan who appointed you, and it was during a really heady time, I would imagine. And you were doing a lot of work for the Federal Council on Aging to focus on housing policy. And fast forward now, it's such a huge topic. I guess I'm wondering, kind of go back to that time, and could you have foreshadowed to the importance of the work you did to right now?
No. I was in Washington during a very heady time. Not a happy time, really. It was during the Nixon impeachment. And I was a law school student, and I had been in the Navy.
And excuse me, you were at Georgetown.
I was at Georgetown, yeah. Okay. And I was in my first year at Georgetown. I'd just come back from the Navy, and I had started law school, and Georgetown University's law school is right on the foot of the hill. And so I said, gee, wouldn't it be fun to get an internship or something on the hill? So I was very politically sophisticated. I didn't even know who my congressman was. So I looked him up and I said, well, I'm a constituent, so he's got to give me 2 minutes.
And this was your representative from Connecticut.
That's right. Second District of Connecticut, Bob Steele, Republican. And his office gave me a 5-minute meeting where I walked in and sat down, and he said, what'd you do in the Navy? I said, well, I was in signals intelligence. And he said, you know what I did before I was a congressman? I said, no, I don't know. So I was in the CIA and I did the same thing. So we talked for an hour and a half.
Wow. So 5 minutes everything. Just morphed, huh?
Yeah. I mean, talk about luck of the draw. And he said, so I assume you're looking for an internship or something? I said, yeah, that would be great. And he said, my AA will call you in a couple of weeks and we'll probably have something for you. So that began my congressional staff career by happening across my congressman. Now, he got appointed to a task force on issues of aging. And he asked me if I'd like to become staff director of that. I'm 23 years old. I have no congressional experience.
And you're not really close to aging either.
Well, you know,
I hope to
be aging, you know, for a long time
right.
more. I said, well, my father was in the nursing home business. He said, fine, that's enough. So he made me staff director while I was in law school of this issue of the House Republican Task Force on Aging. And we were lucky enough to have the ability to hire people without paying them by giving them graduate credit. So I had 8 or 9 really smart PhD and master's students who knew way more about the subject than I did. And we put together some legislation. And that legislation came right during the height of the Nixon impeachment process. Gerry Ford was our boss, and then all of a sudden, instead of minority leader, he's president of the United States. Mm. And in the Housing Act of 74, we managed to get an amendment into that bill, which created a HUD program for housing for the elderly, sponsored by nonprofits. And it passed, became law, and I then was ready to graduate from law school, trying to figure out what to do next. And I was lucky to have three choices. I had a big law firm, I had the Justice Department, antitrust division, or a law firm that had two other lawyers and was going to be working on housing for the elderly under this program that I helped to get done. So I took that last choice and spent the next 25 years doing that, trying to figure out how to develop housing for the elderly around the country by nonprofits. So it created a career by the luck of the draw. So to say that I knew what I was doing, you know, the world just has its opportunities. And sometimes when you show up, stuff happens.
Well, A, how fortuitous of your father's background, really, in the nursing home. So you had a little bit, even if it wasn't a direct, you know, knowledge.
Well, yeah, I had worked for him, and I was the guy who mopped the floors every day. That was my job. So wow. That was my experience.
And then secondly, am I to understand correctly that you were kind of helping create the cornerstone of HUD?
Well, the HUD program that provided that service, yeah.
That must make you feel immensely proud to have been part of that.
Well, it was, you know, whenever I travel around, I've got projects in, I don't know, 35 states. And I will often go visit these facilities. And it's, you know, lawyering and getting to do this for people, what a great combination.
And it takes, I would think, Jamie, you know, more than just a modicum of compassion to operate adequately for the elderly. There's so much that happens. There are so many layers in there. And it's so human. Do you feel like that's something that's unique in you, that you were able to kind of pull all of this together in support of them and their health and how they were taken care of?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was an opportunity that I had that I didn't feel particularly qualified to do, but it was like most of my life, I get thrown in the deep end and told to swim. And so once I got to the law firm, nonprofits are wonderful people and they're in a mission to do wonderful things. But very often nonprofits have hearts of gold and heads of lead, and they are great at empathy and they are great at the joy of helping, and they are terrible very often on organizing and actually finding a way to get it done.
Very little business acumen.
Yes. So for whatever business acumen I had, I put it to work to help these folks get to their goal. And so it's extraordinarily satisfying 25 years.
And as you look now, and as we all look and at aging, it's coming closer and closer for all of us. Do you kind of approach that piece of it, and do you talk to other people about this? Do you feel a sense of hope that things are going to be okay on that front as you keep, you know, fighting the fight for folks?
Well, we're in this big river, and everybody who is old now exists and has been around for a long time. It's not like it's a surprise that they show up. You got to be around for 65 years before you enter that category. And every community is different. Every state is different. Cultures are different. And how people take care of aging people is different in the United States, in different communities, and all over the world. And we have created in America a number of opportunities for that to happen in all sorts of ways. And it ranges from simply having a little bit of help at home. People want to stay home. They don't want to leave. They don't want to leave their neighborhoods. They don't want to leave their friends. They want to have the support they've always had. And so if you leave and go to a facility, you're giving up something really substantial. And I think as a society, we undervalue and underinvest in at-home care. And I think that should be the first mission. But where that's not possible, where more help is needed, then we need to create facilities. And they are so specific, following the money that's available to do X, Y, or Z. You can do something in independent living. You can do more in assisted living. You can do more in a nursing home. You can do more in hospice. And all of those categories are simply based on where the money is. And if there's money to do it, then it gets done. And if there isn't, it doesn't. And that's, it's a shame in a lot of ways. It doesn't follow a more organic route. But the reality is just about every area that needs something available has something available.
I think it's interesting that you talk about aging in place. And I mean, this is something that I'll just say the Japanese have known about this forever.
Yeah.
And they rally around and revere their elders and their seniors and don't put them someplace. But that's if you have the family and the wherewithal. We're scattered these days, which makes it so difficult.
Yeah, I grew up in this little town in Connecticut, and my mother had 10 brothers and sisters. Wow. And we all lived in the same town, and then they started moving and making the big move all the way to West Hartford, Connecticut, all of 20 miles away. And so in growing up, all of my family was within a 25-mile radius. I'm now in touch with many of my senior cousins who were in their 70s and 80s. And I'll be visiting people who live next door to me when we were growing up who now live in Oregon. My oldest son lives in Los Angeles. And there are parts of that family all over the country. And most of them are not in places where they have family support. And so we have to deal with the fact that we are a scattered people and living in the village of our birth and our parents' birth and our grandparents' birth. It just is very unusual. And so we make family out of neighbors. And Maine's a great place to do that.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're not blood relations, but they are very much part of the family. I just want to point out that over the past 40 years, you've worked on more than 100 projects in 29 states, including a program that housed 200,000 plus seniors around the country. And I just want to say thank you for that.
Oh, that's you're quite amazing. Welcome. It's been my joy.
Another big part of your practice has been developing and working with teams on electric transmission systems. And, you know, it's so funny because what you work on is very much in the news on so many different levels, from senior housing to electric projects. We're in a really exciting time right now.
Oh, my God, we are. Back in 1999, one of the people in my firm came to me and said, could you help with a project finance for this new emerging industry? And I didn't know anything about it. I just knew that they needed to raise some money and get it documented. That's what I had been doing for the previous 25 years. So I went to work on it. And to make a long story short, we wound up putting together a project with clients of my firm and a number of other entities that wanted to build a subsea cable project from New Jersey to Long Island under the ocean. And that hadn't been done between those two points. It'd been done very rarely anywhere.
So that's on the ocean floor when you say subsea.
Yes.
So
it's actually buried under the ocean floor.
Okay.
And so by, again, interesting but not planned a strategy, I wound up as general counsel to an organization doing one of those first-time projects. And in 2005, we closed a financing that was about $750 million. And in 2007, the project came online and now delivers about 20% of the power to Long Island, New York, every day.
Fantastic. Wow. What are you working on now?
Well, the world has shifted some in the last couple of years. And what's sort of revolutionary is that the states, and particularly the coastal states in the East, starting from Maine, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and Maryland, have decided that they're tired of waiting for federal or regional officials to provide the infrastructure and the programs and the funding for offshore wind. And as a result, they have, each state has passed legislation or gubernatorial mandates to build an enormous amount of offshore wind. As of a couple of days ago, when New Jersey issued an order, Governor Murphy issued an order to go to 7,500 megawatts of offshore wind. New York has already approved 9,000, Connecticut 2,000, Massachusetts soon to be at 6. It adds up to about 30,000 megawatts, which put into sort of numbers of nuclear plants, that's about 45 or 50 nuclear plants worth of power, a lot of power. And so our clients who have been working on transmission in sort of a smaller area where our cable projects were anywhere from 8 miles to 60 miles, we're now looking at connecting the offshore wind resource with the shoreland with an offshore grid. And so that's what we're up to now.
So it's kind of like a relay effect. So you have the energy coming in, and maybe describe that for me. It sounds
sure.
like the line
well,
comes in.
So when you have an offshore wind farm and they're being approved at levels of like 800 megawatts, that's a lot of wind turbines. Those get collected on low voltage and they go to a central spot in the ocean. And from there, there's a cable that brings them to shore to connect to the onshore grid. Utilities, typical utilities in each state, have jurisdiction over the transmission that's terrestrial. And they build the grid and they are regulated by FERC through the ISOs. None of the tariffs that these people operate under contemplates a grid that's offshore. So while you have generation somewhere 80 to 100 miles offshore, and you have the place where you connect onshore, there's this big area in between that isn't well regulated, isn't well understood, and the industry, which is fairly new in the United States, is beginning to evolve into how do we deal with this area. If each wind farm connects with a generator lead from just that wind farm to shore, you will very soon wind up with a lot of wires coming in and a very difficult ability to actually integrate the maximum amount of offshore wind into the system, because wind doesn't blow all the time.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's an intermittent resource. And so sometimes it's blowing like crazy and the whole 800 megawatts is coming in, and sometimes it's much lower. And the system needs to be able to deal with the injection of this intermittent resource. And that's the challenge of what this offshore grid will do. It will provide support and the controls so that each one of those wind farms can connect to a central place offshore, and then that power can come in a rational and controlled way.
So it provides consistency, in other words.
It provides consistency, control, and reliability.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how far we've come.
Yes.
And yet how long it's taken to get here. It's kind of both at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the world presents opportunities and changes start to happen. And it's showing up and being ready to challenge an opportunity. One of the joys I have, I changed law firms back in 2011. I left a firm that had 8 or 9 lawyers, and now I'm at Bernstein with 130. And doing work of the sophistication and the complexity that we have is frankly beyond any one lawyer's comprehension. And you just can't do it by yourself. You can't even do it in a firm of 8 or 9 because everybody's got what they're doing and everybody's always not available to help out with a complex project. But here with amazing concentration of talent, it's amazing what you can get done. And it's been the biggest joy to be able to go from having to worry about everything to having people I can trust and rely on and go to who are available and ready to help and ready to join a team and do this complex stuff. And we do $1.5 billion projects from this firm in Portland, Maine, and we challenge the big boys in New York and Boston and Washington all the time. And we negotiate with them and we deal with them and we get things done. So it's a unique opportunity.
People seem to be happier here too. The commute is a little bit shorter and we have the beauty, which is right outside of our windows.
Well, here. When I left Washington in 1982, my commute was 1.5 hours each way from Montgomery County down to Gucci Gulch on K Street. And we made a deal when we came up to live no more than 15 minutes from the office and try to find a place as close to the ocean as we could afford. And so we found a lot and we built a house, and it's 12 minutes from getting into my car to parking here at the garage at Bernstein Shore. And the view on the way down Route 1 and Route 88 is just beautiful. So I'm reminded and thankful every day on the way in and on the way home.
Sometimes it requires being in other places. I understand fully. Living in a car is not really ideal. Let's give your email address if we could, if people want to get in contact with you or chat with you further about this.
Sure. jbroder@bernsteinshore.com.
Broder, B-R-O-D-E-R.
Right.
And Jamie, I guess I'm going through the, I was looking at the core values earlier here at Bernstein, and I think that you've hit on several that are just so important. And I love the fact that these were so carefully planned out, really tailored to what Bernstein Shore seems to represent. We believe in diversity, respect, collegiality, committed to service and community, highest level of professional excellence, practical, innovative, and entrepreneurial. We put our clients' interests first. What else would you like people to know about Bernstein Shore?
Well, I think the most important of those values to me is that of community service in the largest context. When I came here, I found that everybody who I was working with had another life. And many of them were involved in community organizations, in the nonprofit community, in the political world. And very few of the folks I dealt with, particularly at the partner level were just lawyers. They wanted to be integral to the place where they lived, and they had a sense of place. And I think that comes from, you know, all the way back to 1915 when the firm was founded. There was a honoring of community service. There was a requirement that as part of your job here, you were involved in the community. It was an expectation. And that has created a culture that is inherently mutually supportive and makes doing really good work possible. There's a lot of places where you read about those standards, but because people don't have a life, don't have time to spend with their family and their children, that their ability to be effective attorneys is really compromised. And I think by recognizing we all have a life, that life is something other than the time we spend in the office, and that's honored and respected and encouraged and expected, that makes it a good place to be.
Jamie, you have a really interesting relationship with now U.S. Senator Angus King, formerly Governor Angus King. He really came to you at a time that he wanted to make a big decision, and you gave him some good advice and some big help. Tell us about that.
Well, Angus and Mary have been friends for a long time, when back in the mid '90s, Maine had a meltdown, political meltdown, with the governor John McKernan and the Speaker of the House, John Martin, coming to blows on the budget, and the government shut down for a period of time. And Angus, as a public figure from his radio show, was very upset, and he decided he was going to run for governor as an independent, try to clean this mess up. And so he called me up, and he said, "Jamie, I'm going to do this. What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I'd be glad to help." And he said, "Well, will you be my finance chairman?" I had done some political fundraising, nothing big, and certainly nothing at this level. So I signed on, and I told him he was going to have to write a check or two as well. And he said, "I better not."
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we raised enough money, and he won an overwhelming victory in his first election by, I think it was, 2 points, that went till about 3 a.m. when we found out he won. And then instead of going into the administration, I was effectively the campaign. I was effectively the party chair, because he didn't have a party, and there was just a lot of stuff that you had to do while being governor that was not governmental, but was political and social. And
yeah, being an independent, it made things a little bit more complicated.
It did. You had no structure behind you. You just had yourself. So that was what I did. And then we did the next election, and he won really overwhelmingly. And it was the most exciting and fulfilling part of my early days in Maine, because I had no election background other than, you know, very marginal stuff. And here I was, again, sort of like Forrest Gump, in the middle of what was going on here. And it was fascinating, and it was exciting, and it was emblematic of what Maine is. And I think the thing that stands out the most was the ice storm, and what happened after the ice storm back in the mid-90s. It was incredibly damaging. There were parts of Maine that were out for well over a month, and nobody died. Nobody froze to death. And there were systems set up, and I got to say, the media was just wonderful to the extent they had power and they were able to have their radios out there. There were setups with call-in centers where people would call in and say, I need a cord of wood. And somebody would call and say, I got it and I live and I'll bring it over. And we spent weeks. I was mostly in the command center. My wife was involved sitting at the, in the center where all the stuff was being sent out and back. And we just watched this community come together and take care of each other. And all the line workers who came from Canada and all over the country. I remember a year later, we did this giant lobster bake for everybody who helped out. And it was what Angus said, Maine's a big small town. And it really made that obvious that that was true.
And it must make you feel so good to feel like what you did, the role you played, actually mattered.
Well, I think everybody wants to matter in the world. And this is a place where there's opportunities to matter. Every person who spends a little time doing something other than their work makes a difference in this place. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to do stuff like that.
Well, Jamie Broder, thank you so much for sharing some of you with us and coming on board here. The SureCast podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's been so interesting and fun to get to know you better. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you for listening to The SureCast, a Bernstein Shore podcast. We hope you have enjoyed the program. To find out more information about the topics discussed in this episode and more, please visit www.bernsteinshore.com/media. Thank you.